Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with the Kia dealers of Ireland. Wherever the next 7 years bring you, Kia are with you all the way.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And Joe at RT.ie. I mentioned yesterday that in the Mother and Baby Home Commission report, there obviously most of it is anonymised. And as we heard last week on Claire Byrne, only one witness, there were 500 witnesses and 19 were before the investigation committee. But only one witness actually managed to get the transcript of their testimony, and they disputed it very, very passionately, and they said this was not what I said, and there was a number of factual errors. But I also mentioned yesterday there's very little reference to the spoken narrative and the spoken experiences of survivors. And in truth, if you go back to the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, Gay Byrne, Marion Finucane, Pat Kenny, Sean O'Rourke, John Bowman, all those programmes featured these stories and indeed documentaries over the years. But there's very little. There was only two references to two radio documentaries. And I read out one of the references, and it said, in 2018, an RT radio documentary told the story of Peggy McCarthy, an unmarried pregnant woman with intellectual disabilities who was refused admission to hospitals in Listowel and Tralee in 1946 and died from eclampsia. Now, we've been contacted by Tony Gearan. Tony, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And your argument is, Tony, that this reference to Peggy McCarthy in the Mother and Baby Home Commission report, they say they got it from the RT radio documentary made by Conor Keane. You say that they're listening to that documentary, they took it up completely wrong. In what way?
They didn't quote Conor Keane correctly.
Okay.
What they said, they marched Peggy Sweeney back up Calvary and to a hill beyond Calvary again by inferring that she was intellectual disabilities. She was no more than you or I. God bless mm-hmm. Well, had an intellectual disability, had she. She came from a family of the McCarthy's Roaches, and they were known in the parish and in the town of Listowel as one of those families who were gifted with intelligence, yeah. Common sense. And they were literate when a lot of other people weren't. And she did have a love child, Matthew, and that's how she's referred to down nowhere. And now she was refused admission. Now, remember this was a crisis pregnancy.
Okay.
Because my father was the man who had to drive her to hospital. He was contacted because they couldn't afford a taxi or a hackney car. And in the morning, he was contacted anyway. They had to come in cycling. And he went and he took that girl pregnant, in a crisis pregnancy, in his car to the hospital where he was refused entry. Now, he was directed to Tralee, where he again refused. Of course, you know yourself, they did have phones and expecting. And she died from, now they called eclampsia, this thing, blood pressure. This, her death was inevitable, willful negligence, which guaranteed her inevitable death. And worse than that, when she was brought, now this is all in Conor Keane's magnificent documentary based on my play, Solo Run, that was produced in
1992
by the Lapeak Theatre Group.
Okay.
And when he brought her home and pulled the girl home on the top of his car, the hackney car and the roof rack, she was refused all the Christian, so-called Christian ceremonies, like a mass, but she was buried all right. But that was her, and she died. It was totally wrong what they said about it. They didn't quote Connor. If they didn't pay any attention to it. Now, it didn't surprise me either that they got it head over heels. If you read the first few lines there, the introduction to the chapter 9, that's page 1.
It's about the attitude. Yeah.
Unmarried mothers. You have it. I just read the first.
Go
unmarried
ahead, yeah.
mother
yeah.
has proved as problematic in Ireland as has in most other European countries. Now that's blown totally out of the water. You're talking about in go to page 6, blown out of water by Gertrude Gaffney, who wrote about the priests, nuns and lay people connected with rescue work in London, spoke with great severity of the unchristian and inhuman attitude in the store towards the unmarried mother, and declared that this attitude made their problem so much more difficult and gave the girl or child very little chance of making good. Because that's what she said. And this thing about saying the rest of Europe, England was our nearest neighbour as well, you know. And this in England, and there was no one else, and forget about the rest of the continent. And now there was a difference made, of course, a distinction between north of England and the south of England.
Okay.
And the north of England were a bit like the Irish themselves, hard-working. And
okay.
All that kind of stuff.
I want to go with this approaches in two headings. First of all, it's commissioned the Mother and Baby Home Commission. Worked for 5 years, lots of staff and legal advisors. And as I said yesterday, in terms of a work of history, no one could quibble with it. Its bibliography is quotes hundreds of books. And as I say, it only quoted, as far as I could find, 3 or 4 radio. Survivor stories, which I know from our wonderful archive here. You only have to listen to John Bowman at 8:30 on a Sunday morning to know how wonderful the RTE archive is. And we've always had brilliant archivists, and the catalogue from Rob Canning back to Noel Shields, they've always been on the ball about cataloguing the content of every programme. It's really important. I don't know, but I presume, I'd love to hear from the Mother and Baby Commission, did they come on to the RTE and say, have you anything in your archives about mother and baby homes? Have you anything in your archives of survivors? But maybe they'll answer that. But you're saying the reference to, and this is the interesting thing about Peggy McCarthy in this report, is that she's actually named. There's very few women.
That's right, yeah.
But you're saying that you can almost, it's only half a paragraph. In 2018...
Three lines. Exactly.
But you're saying even in those 3 lines, they got it wrong. Because, they say an unmarried pregnant woman, which is Peggy McCarthy, with intellectual disabilities. Where did they pull that out of? Okay. Now tell us the story of Peggy McCarthy again. It's 1946. She falls pregnant, and
she was having a love child.
Okay.
At that time there was no motor cars, there was no phones. Okay.
Okay.
Back in 1946, and it was a crisis pregnancy.
Okay.
That meant people had their babies at home.
Okay.
They sent to my father for a taxi. I've ordered this in a play, solo run.
Okay. But you're saying, just to be clear, given the context of what we're talking about, Peggy was at home, she was with her family when she was pregnant.
With her family and midwife, you know.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, however, she needed help. The pregnancy
became... She was a crisis pregnancy.
Okay, so your father was asked to use his car...
Taxi car,
to take Peggy.
He had to be contacted. It was a good mile and a half away. And at that time, dark roads and everything. But anyway, he went and he brought that. Now, the hospital was halfway between, you could say, where we lived and that girl's home.
Okay.
And anyway, he brought the girl in the car and he was refused entry at the hospital. She was refused entry because she was unmarried.
My God.
This is a crisis pregnancy. I can't put more emphasis on that crisis. And directed to Tralee. Now, at that time, the motor cars weren't the same as they are today, neither were the roads. And anyway, she was taken to Tralee Hospital, where, again, of course, communication had been made. And the nuns, again, refused her entry there. And I know for a fact, the nun that refused her entry, it bothered her for the rest of her life. and directed to the Union in Killarney. Now, this is all in the
plan. The work of
Conor Keane's documentary, okay, and my father's work.
And we'll hear the clip from that in a sec. But Tony, who instructed, or were they operating off their own bat? Who would have known, by the way? Who instructed the two hospitals to refuse Peggy, not because she was intellectually disabled, but because she was pregnant outside of marriage? Which, by the way, she wasn't intellectually disabled. That's Tony's point. It should never be in that report. And he doesn't know where they got it from. But that who instructed the nuns, to these two hospitals, to refuse entry to a very, very sick person?
Look, as well, you know, this country, the priests ran the country. And forget about the county councils, and I know there was rules there instructing the councils, county councils, that was their problem on married mothers and run the hospitals. But the priests ran it. The church ran it. And so, otherwise, you go against the church, and that was the end of your seat in the Dáil Éireann or the county council, say one word against them. Man's an inhumanity to woman, and make no mistake about that. And
so you're saying the parish priest contacted the two hospitals?
Well, of course. Okay. Well, the priest appointed the nurses. They had the jobs, the same as they appointed teachers. And the parish priest, well, he'd have courts. The Knights of Columbanus were strong in every town, as you know, still are probably. But anyway, there was always those. This was poor people. You were the poorest. Poor hard-working people. And so they were only treated like worse than you treat an animal in the field. And, you have the jure and the factor, and you have the rules probably from the county council stating that, but they were directed to make those rules by the McQuaid's of the world. For God's sake, you could do nothing without their permission, or you would get close to your business.
So Peggy was refused entry because the nuns obviously were told...
She was unmarried.
Oh, my God. So she was refused entry to the hospital, even though she was quite unwell. Where did she die?
She died... She had to be driven then to Killarney.
Okay.
And she died in the Union.
Oh, the workhouse, as it was previously.
Well...
The county home, and then...
That is the best of people wound up in the workhouse. They were poor people who couldn't feed themselves for different reasons, you know. But, like, even if you go back to Jesus, there's nothing secret about 1940, was it? 40, it was 1740 or something, Brian Merriman's Midnight Court. Anyone should listen to it. And he himself was a love child, supposed to be anyway. His father was a priest, it said, or a landlord. And
Peggy McCarthy dies in the Union. What do we know? What age she is? Obviously, a youngish woman.
I think she was 25.
25-year-old woman. Okay, she dies after being refused entry to two hospitals. Being refused entry because she was not because she was pregnant. It was because she was unmarried.
Unmarried.
Okay.
Unmarried.
Now, where was Peggy buried?
She was buried because the gates of the church had to open them because they were threatened to be broken down. Crowd had gathered in the town. Now, she was still refused entry in the local parish church, and she had to be taken without prayers, remember, back to the hospital church, and from there she was taken to the graveyard. And I have the confirmation that prayers might have been said at the graveside, but there was no funeral mass. She wasn't worthy of it. She was unclean. And they would have had many supporters of that, like, attitude towards the poor. And that's how it was. People that didn't have money. There was no more Christianity. Like that woman, Gertrude Gaffney, said back in 1436 when she said about the attitudes of Ireland, butcher. That's it. But I was very upset about this intellectual disability.
I know you are, and you say in your context, she was beaten up by the church, and now her memory is being wronged by the Mother and Baby Home Commission.
Yeah, and I wrote a play on this, and I gave a patch him to Tira twice over again, five nights. specialist store, St. John's Inn, here in Dublin.
Now, what can, Tony, sorry, what can be, see, the Mother and Baby Home Commission have decided that they're not answering any queries or questions or, because there's a number, we've had a significant number of questions about different issues raised and validated in the report, a number of people questioning it. What can you do? Like, what can anyone do? What can RTE do? Do you write to them and say, can you take out that phrase?
I don't know. What do
see, it's on, the problem now is it's on the record.
This is only one, now, I'll tell you, I was on to Mrs. Carlos, God bless her, down that
Catherine,
woman, and I tell you, she must be an old woman from the work she has done.
Brilliant, yeah.
And what you can do about it, it's in print, it's out there.
Yeah.
But what a horrible, horrible injustice has been perpetrated on the family of the McCarthys and poor Peggy's memory. I'm telling you, they battered her up Calvary, and now they're battering higher again with that intellectual disability. And remember, she had families to know. My generation nearly all gone. I'm in the springtime in my 80s, but by crikey, this thing drove me. This is outrageous.
Yeah,
if they hadn't said, if they had left, just, you know, all they had to do was listen to Conor Keynes. I know them.
Well, they said they did. You see, after two radio documentaries, they quote, they reference that radio documentary. And so they only listened to two. They didn't listen to hundreds of hours from Gay Bourne, Mary Finucane, and Pat Kenny, Sean O'Rourke, or Joe Duffy, or anyone else, Claire Bourne, sir, anyone. They didn't ask for anything that had been on those programs about the mother and baby.
Joe,
homes. But anyway,
if they had any one of those unmarried mothers who did have loved children, I'll tell you, they would have hopped on that straight away. These are living witnesses.
I completely take your point, and they're telling their stories. They're not being manipulated by anybody. They tell their stories in their way, and oftentimes they are more comfortable telling them on air than putting them down in writing or writing to newspapers
exactly.
or whatever. Now, you also say you challenge what the commission say, that she died from eclampsia, but apparently that's on her death cert.
I meant was the inevitability of her death because
she was treated, yeah.
Of her inhuman treatment.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
And it was.
She could have that among many other things.
But Tony, just to come back to your point about, the parish priest ruled the roost, but the people let him rule the roost. Do you follow me?
I'm not going to agree with you. Who formed the thinking of the people? Who formed their thinking? Man and woman, the church. They were dying in dread of hell. Sex was a sin, whether it was love before marriage or whatever you like to call it. Yeah. And that was a mortal sin. That was a highway to hell. And they could bell ring you off the altar or off the pulpit. Yeah. This was out. And they had that power because no one dare speak out against them. And I know the attitude. My own grandmother would say, we're not worthy to touch the hem of a priest's garment. Can you imagine that for fear and dread? Superstition, pishos, call it what you like.
And the priest was the most educated in the invariably.
Because they were the bosses then, to see the educated. Don't know how many, thanks be to Christ, he came along. And to see all these McCarthy family, I know them in particular, and the Roche family, highly intelligent family. These, if they had the benefit of this free education at the time, they'd be surgeons and all this kind of thing.
Yeah, I've come back to being read off the altar, and just for younger listeners, that is where the priest would get up and say, I won't use Peggy's name, but Mary Morphy or whatever is pregnant and she's not married and she's brought shame on the locality and all this carry on. But what the commission say about that is, it should be noted, while there is evidence of such denunciations, they were not as common as is sometimes suggested.
It shouldn't be said once. What nonsense to make a statement like that. Almighty God to say it once from a pulpit and banging it.
Well, as I quoted last week, there was an edict issued by a bishop in Galway to all his parishes saying, including June, by the way, in saying that if anyone became pregnant in the area, she should be read off the altar and her family for bringing shame to the locality. So, but anyway, the commission says they were not as common as is sometimes suggested. Now, Tony, let me ask you this question, just because
Brown was summoned. You know, the bishop summoned the ministers and anyone else to their palaces.
Yeah.
And they could not take a person to make notes at those meetings, right? Yeah. So now you know where I'm coming from.
That's the history books. Now, it's in the history books, you're right, and we had Noel Brown's daughter on yesterday at the end. But the other point, you say the priest had the power that a county councillor or a TD could not go against him.
But hang on.
But the county council or the TD is voted in by the people, not by the parish priest.
And remember, none of them were women.
I know that. But do you see my point? Like, the people did go along with what... I know your answer from earlier on. But how were TDs... You're saying the TDs had to bow and scrape to the church, but...
They were happy washing their hands. They saw this as a problem, not... And I told you about how Gertrude Gaffney looked. They looked after him in London. This was an Irish thing. Yeah. Irish. And make no mistake about it. And you never heard someone standing up in the altar standing up in a hustings and send the Catholic Church for what they were doing wrong and what they were, because they wouldn't get a vote in the parish.
Yeah. And there was
They were dying in dread of hell.
Yeah. But you know, one of the strong arguments, it's in the commission report, that families first and foremost should take the blame.
What a load of bloody nonsense.
Why?
Who created the... Come here. Who, Joe, excuse me.
Okay.
Who created the thinking of the people, the common man? It was the clerk. No one else. They fashioned the thinking. No one wins. They had complete power.
And did Peggy's baby survive?
So I'll discuss that with you some other time, if you don't mind, please. That's
okay.
Another thing.
Okay.
And
I understand.
I have no problem discussing it, but not on here, thank you.
Okay, but the mother, the point is, Peggy died. She didn't have intellectual disabilities, as the commission report as verbatim. And your argument is she didn't die from eclampsia, she died from being refused entry to two hospitals because
they should have extrapolated on that.
Okay.
Just a line or two to say about the refusal. I mean, that's a glossing over the whole thing. They were afraid to handle a hot potato, I tell you that. Call a spade a spade. Now, Joe.
Yes.
I could go on forever, but I'm so infuriated by this person who cannot speak for themselves from the grave. Oh, God.
Okay. Like,
and then Ned Sullivan then addressed the Shannon when the store said no to barbaric inhumanity of religious towards an unmarried mother. That's Dawn and Nolan and the Kerryman and Howard Hart page with. And that was only back in 2017. And there wasn't a word on the radio over it.
Okay, but your
Kerry radio indeed.
Okay, but your point is that the people of Listowel stood up to the priest on that occasion.
Now, Joe, that's the collective. That sounds very nice.
Okay.
The people of her own class.
Okay.
Okay, they marched. And remember, this was the month of February, and there was no lighting. They gathered when the word got out, and they're the fast going around with a coffin on top of the car. By Japers, and everyone knew about what had happened.
And the church,
Bush,
the church gates are locked.
There was no radio.
The church gates are locked. Peggy wasn't.
The gates against her, she wasn't allowed in.
Oh, God. Okay.
This is all in Connor's.
I know, and indeed your own, and the Connor's.
And my own play.
Yeah.
My own play was presumed by the Larty, Danny Hannon, Dennis Mahaney.
Okay. Tony, the documentary by Conor and the Doc on One Unit is still up on the RTE website. Again, I just come back, an incredible archive in here. An incredible archive in here that I know Rob and people have done it before, and there's more than Rob, there's a crew of them around there. But they bend over backwards to try and help people. Researchers, historians or whatever were looking for anything that was in the public domain, which would have been on various programmes. Tony Gearn, stay well, Tony, and God bless Peggy, and thanks for remembering her, and thanks for spotting that mistake. It is a mistake, isn't it?
I can't forgive it. I can't forgive it. Okay. It's lack of professionalism as far as I'm concerned. That would never get through you. That should never. It's only a couple of lines, but my God, have okay. they tarnished the reputation of that family. Joe,
yes,
thank you very, very much, and okay. your staff.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for pointing
thank
that out.
To us.
Okay. That's Tony. Tony Gearn. Thank you. That's Tony Gearn below, in the stall. Patrick Anthony McQuaid. How are you, Patrick?
I'm fine, thanks.
And there's another chapter in about Bethany Holmes, and you are a Bethany Home baby.
Yes, by Bethany. Yes, indeed.
And tell us about the Bethany. It was a Protestant home, wasn't it? Again, to use those labels.
Yeah, it was a Protestant home, but it had connections with the Irish Church Missions as well.
Okay.
And my mother went in there in 1947 and gave birth to me. And she left me there, but 2 weeks later, I was moved down to Tipperary to a nurse mother.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I was removed. I remembered quite well, actually. I was removed. My first memory was when I was 1 year old.
Okay.
But I was removed by a Church of Ireland vicar from my nurse mother and taken up to Dublin to the Children's Fold, Children's Home, which again was run by the Irish Church Missions. For what reason, I do not know. I couldn't walk too good. And then I was moved from there to the Bowley Home, which again was an Irish Church Missions establishment. And later, in October 1950, I was examined, and I was found that my heart was irregular, and SA was not definite. I'm not quite sure what SA was. My chest was clear.
Okay.
Extremities cold and blue.
Okay, so Patrick, you contacted us off on foot of what the number of women were saying yesterday, that when, in response to this finding in the commission, there's no doubt that women and mother baby homes were subjected to emotional abuse, but there's very little evidence of physical abuse and no evidence of sexual abuse, and a number of women were actually contesting that last week. But the women yesterday were contesting the state of the children that they collected from the mother and baby homes. Now, what condition that amounted to physical abuse, what condition were you in, Patrick, when you were taken?
How would I know? The only reason I'm saying this is because I was examined by the doctor,
okay.
and they moved me from the Bethany via the nurse mother, and then two homes later, I end up having rickets, and cheeks and lips were blue, and then moved on again to Smiley's home.
Yeah.
And then moved illegally, taken to Northern Ireland in 1950.
So you're saying, and you've sent it into us, the doctor's report on you said, it was noted that this child, Patrick, came to us in very poor condition and with cold blue extremities, continuous anemia and obvious rickets of the head. He was not talking much and would not play with other children. His heart was irregular, cheeks and lips were blue. The prescription is to have cod liver oil daily, vitamin C 25 milligrams, or oranges, marmite or on bread, or soup, and sunlight. You were what, 2 years then? 2 years of age?
Yeah, I remember. I was always in a fetal position, and I wouldn't talk. And it messed up my memory in the sense of I didn't know if it was true or not. And then eventually in 2010, I got my own records myself.
Okay.
Then I found out what had happened to me. But everything was in my head, so I couldn't believe myself even, because I didn't know if it was true or not. But when I read it in black and white on the written page, and there was names and places, then I realized, yeah, all this did happen to me. And psychologically, it didn't do me too much good either.
And Patrick, did you give evidence to the commission?
I did indeed. I had 2.5 A4 pages, which took 4 hours, question and answer,
okay,
through it. And when I left it, I said to my wife, Marina, that was it. I was finished, because I'd spent 7 years working with three other people, to get the commission set up in the first place.
Good man, yeah.
And I don't know if I'm allowed to say who the people are or not, but they worked very, very hard to get it where it was.
Okay. And do you, I know it's a massive report, and there's not many hard copies of it. A lot of it is on. Do you know if your evidence is quoted in the report?
No idea at all. I've asked for a hard copy of it, and I sent an email to the Minister of Children trying to confirm. There's a section where it says that if the child was in the Bethany home less than 6 months, they wouldn't be entitled to redress.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
Did you read that?
Yeah, and then after 1973 as well, which doesn't apply in your case.
It doesn't apply in my case.
Yeah. I'm up as far as just under 2,000 pages. And the only reference I've found, so, well, obviously it's a chapter heading, which I'll get to. But was one, the Bethany home featured a lot when I was reading about the Regina Chaley hostel in Dublin, off Richmond Street there, George Street in Dublin. But the main way it featured, bizarrely, Patrick, was that the main propulsion, it seemed to be, for Frank Duff and the Legion of Mary to set up the Regina Chaley, which had its own awful, awful difficulties and epidemics and very high debt rates at times. But the main propulsion for them to set it up was to stop Catholic women going into the Bethany home. They didn't want Catholic babies going next or near a Protestant institution. But and then the other point I'm making about, are you quoted? I read the chapters on Castle Pollard, and there was 5,000 women went through Castle Pollard. Obviously, a number of them would be dead. But of those 5,000 women, the commission quotes testimony from 5 of them, and including 2 of them get a paragraph each. That's it, 100 words each. So I just I'd love for you to be, when you do get the hard copy, to see, can you recognise your own evidence in it?
And well, I looked at the Bethany home section.
Okay.
And to me, it was just charts and figures and
There's 2 each.
Short.
Yeah,
there was no personal testament sort of. Well,
there should be like in Castle Pollard, there is a chapter of stats and figures. A lot of the charts are I don't see the point in a lot of them. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But maybe when you get a hard copy, there should be a chapter on testimony from the Bethany Holmes scenario. Now, I would also say, and that's why I'd love you to get your own. I'd love to hear from people whose own testimony they gave. Of the 500 people who gave testimony and the 19 people who were before the investigation committee, can we hear from them if they've managed to go through this document, which is extremely hard? But what for example, one of the women in Castle Pollard who did actually give evidence, as I say, 5,000, and I think there's 5, and then there's 2 people who gave affidavits, and they warrant a paragraph each. But the mother in Bethany, the mother and baby home commission says that one of the, well, this happens a lot, but that one of the women in Castle Pollard said that she subsequently, this is the quote from the woman, she subsequently learned that her baby was taken off her to Shannon and gone to America before she could turn her head. She said she subsequently learned that the adoptive parents handed money over to the nuns at Castle Pollard, and that payments continued for a number of years. Now, the problem is that in a footnote, the Mother and Baby Home Commission say the witness, i.e. this woman, did not provide any evidence to substantiate this statement. Like, what evidence were they expecting? What evidence could that woman give?
Well, I've got evidence that my mother had to pay Irish Church Mission £6 a month.
Okay, well, hold on to that. Hold on to that, but...
And that was a lot of money back in 1950 or 1949.
Okay. And what is Patrick...
And I felt, you know, even reading that, I was angry, you know, with my mother. But at the same time, I felt so sorry for her, thinking, because that was so much money. And she was forced to do that. And in that document to pay, she had to agree not to have any contact with me again before I was removed up to Northern Ireland.
Oh, God.
You know, and I did, the anger was there, but as time goes by, I healed, you know.
Okay.
But I could not believe, she never told anybody, and she didn't tell any of her family, and anybody knew about the existence of me. But then, when I was searching for her, which I eventually found her, I was in contact with PAC, P-A-C-T, yeah. Protestant Adoption People.
Yeah.
And they said they didn't know anything about me at all, at all, at all. And then in 1989, the law in Northern Ireland changed where I could get access. So I went up there on the off chance, and they said yes. So I had to go through a legal thing, and eventually I got my original birth certificate because it was held up in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And through that, I managed to find, I got my original surname. There was no internet those days. And eventually, through the telephone book, I checked out all the names, and eventually I found a family member, and I found her. But then PAC sent me a letter and told me the information I already knew, and enclosed another letter. And inside that was an envelope. And in that envelope was a birth certificate of another child that my mother gave birth to.
Okay.
He was born 4 years later. But he wasn't. Okay. He was born in Wicklow. And then I just knew he was, you know, he was 3 months old. And he was taken away.
And given the terms of reference of the commission, were you asked at any stage when you as I say, 500 people sat in front of them out of 57,000, I accept a lot of those people would be there, but 500 people and 19 before the investigation committee would have been kind of cross-examined or whatever, in a gentle way, I'm sure. But were you asked at any stage, Patrick, what can the state do to help you now?
At the
hearing, at the where you gave your evidence.
No, I was really angry with that, and afterwards I thought about it, and I thought, why didn't they ask each individual, where can you see this going forward? How will we be able to help?
Hmm.
The commission finally has a report, and I just found that really, really odd. It made common sense to me. Why have a report, and especially now that I've seen bits of it and heard so much on your program, read about it in the Times and whatnot, that the commission, the report's just sitting there, but there's no steps, there's no forward movement.
Okay, well, that remains to be seen. But, Patrick, what would help you now?
What would help me now is I've got arthritis of my knees and my right hand.
Okay.
And my local doctor said that I couldn't get any help on my medical card because of the waiting lists. So I had to go private. So I ended up having to go to the Mater Hospital twice to get treatment at €190 a pop.
Yeah. So you would like a medical card that would cover that?
Yeah, well, I'm on a pension, so...
Yeah.
And at 74, you know...
Okay.
I can't see... I'm lucky to get the treatment I'm getting. It isn't proper, but it's easing. But they should have asked more questions instead of just sort of digging, and then just finding the report me finding the report just full of just sort of figures and statements and things. It doesn't really help the survivor, because we're still surviving even after the report's been published.
Yeah.
So even in a worse way, in some ways, if you understand what I mean, because it never leaves you.
But I know the Magdalen Laundry survivor's got an enhanced medical card, they call it.
Yeah, I remember I was up in Dublin when Kenny did the apology was with the Magdalen Laundries that day in the Doyle and things like that.
Great campaign.
And hopefully they...
And Patrick, you mentioned your other your fellow activists and campaigners in Fair Play. But Patrick, what is the feeling a week after the report was published? What is the, insofar as you can gauge it, what is the general reaction from survivors about the report?
Well, the people I've been in touch with are exactly the same as they keep asking questions. Why? Why is there not more? Why was it done that way? Mm-hmm. And we had our doubts about it a couple of years ago. And when they kept putting an extra year on it, I was thinking, oh, I'm going to wonder how much that's going to cost. And it kept going on year by year. And I remember when we were with Alan Shatter in 2013, mm-hmm. He told us, yes, there's going to be a commission of inquiry set up. And we thought, great. And then we thought, maybe it'll take a year. And here we are in 21 and it's published.
As you said, Patrick, no one is getting any, none of us are getting any younger.
No.
None of the survivors getting any younger. Okay.
Psychologically, it's not good for the people I've spoken to. And they're angry as well because of what happened to them. But they're more angry because there's no solution coming out of the report. That's up to the Minister of Children to pop up with something. He said he'd do something by April time.
Okay.
But I don't know. There's more people, more damaged than I was.
Yeah.
Feel for them. And to wait all that time, it seems like a lifetime. Well, it has been a lifetime. But when I first started in 2007 to try and get things going with Niall Meehan.
Yeah, and he did great work on the Bethany Homes, as you did.
He did,
Great work.
And he should be given a lot more credit for what he did, and a very knowledgeable person to speak to.
Yeah.
And I'm just so sad that it ended up like this, you know. And I feel within my heart, it feels empty again, you know, because everybody's looking for an answer. Everybody's looking for a solution, something to give them some comfort. And they lost all that comfort before once, and now they're losing it again. And the comfort from the government is what we need. We need a big hug from the government to say, okay, survivors, we'll look after you. But from this report, I can't see that happening. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. I don't know.
Okay, you're very fair. Patrick, I was, when I saw your name this morning, I was looking, you're an artist. You're a visual artist. I'm going on your website. You're a visual artist, photographer, poet, performance artist and curator. And some of your art has gone into space.
It has indeed, yes.
What does that mean?
Well, it actually went up in space, yeah.
Oh, in a spaceship?
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah,
a friend in America is a curator, and he was working with NASA.
Okay.
And the last American space shuttles, two, went up in 2011.
Right.
And they picked out 128 artists to do a piece to go up. And I asked, could I ask my wife as well, Marina? Mm-hmm. So Marina and I, we had to do two pieces, postcard size, and take a photograph of ourselves holding the piece.
Yeah.
The piece was sent over to NASA, and it was scanned, and it went up on this space.
And was it to entertain the astronauts, or just...
Yeah, well, they don't get Coronation Street or EastEnders or anything.
Okay. So, or Fair City.
Our Fair City. They had to look at something, so they did 182 artworks to look at, and then the artworks were exhibited at Cape Canaveral and then Chicago Museum of Contemporary Art and then Fort Worth Community Art Center. So, yeah, I'm the only Irish artist who's exhibited in space.
Brilliant.
Which is lovely.
And that incredible photograph that you have on, I was looking at it here, the on the front of your website, the stretching out into the water. Where was that taken?
Camongan in Loch Allen.
Oh, beautiful.
And pier. I did a performance piece using the round circles of wood along the pier.
Yeah.
And then I had a stone on each one. And I went into the water. And then I came out of the water with a bunch of flowers and walked along and put a stone on each piece of wood. Yeah. And then came up and sat down and read some poetry. It was for Culture Night.
Well done. Well done.
I'm glad you liked the photograph.
And I will tweet that as well on at Joe Liveline and at RTE Liveline so people can link into it. Patrick Anderson McQuaid, is that the correct pronunciation? Q-U-O-I-D?
Yes.
Yeah, Patrick Anderson McQuaid. Thank you so much, Patrick.
Appreciate it, Joe.
Stay well and thank you for your great campaigning over the years.
And no, indeed, and thanks to the other people, Niall Meehan and people like that, and Derek Dempster and John Hill.
Okay.
There's a lot of people.
Okay, and as soon as you get more information, if you feel you were quoted in the report, in fairness, let us know. Thanks
indeed.
That's Patrick Anderson McQuaid, 51551 Wycheland.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie. Yesterday, Josephine contacted us, one of the many survivors, and she was saying that she pointed out a letter she had from Shanross Abbey in Tipperary in 1966. Won't give the exact date for obvious reasons, but it was sent to her family, the family that adopted her. But it was about the child that had been adopted already, if you follow me, who in other words would be Josephine's older brother in that family. And Josephine was pointing out she found a letter to the parents from Sister Hildegard in the Shanross Abbey saying, I had chosen a very nice baby boy of a very good family for you. He was born, date of birth is there. He will be in his 50s now. But I now find he has a slight birthmark, light link, which apparently is a strawberry kiss on your forehead. Hardly a disability, my God. On his forehead. So I have changed to another boy, a very equally good family who was born, the date is given. The age of the younger boy might appeal more to you, but in each case, I can vouch for the family. But she was almost like a market. That boy had a slight birthmark on his forehead, and so she changed the boy to another boy that the family took. And Josephine was saying somewhere out there is a person, hopefully hale hearty and is having a good life, that has a slight, probably gone now, long gone, a slight birthmark on his forehead, who could have been Josephine's sister, if you follow me, but instead, because Sister Hildegard took him out of the running, so to speak. Now, James McCourt. James, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
50 years ago, you and your wife adopted a child from the poor Clares in Stamullen.
Yeah, actually 53, 54 years.
Okay, tell us about that process.
Well, we were married a number of years and with no sign of a family, so we decided to adopt. And as you appreciate, there was no mobiles or emails in those days. We were told there was a home in Stamullen, St. Joseph's mother and baby, baby home.
Okay.
So we wrote to them and told them we wished to adopt, and they wrote back and asked about our background, we were working, et cetera, et cetera. And we were given a date to come up and to bring a letter of reference from a priest that knew us.
Okay.
Which I was able easily enough to obtain, because it was the Redemptorist Fathers were in my parish and I was well known to them. So,
and what were they hoping would be in that letter, James?
I suppose that the priest did actually know me quite well. That the family background.
Okay.
That, you were suitable and all that.
Okay, but did the priest interview you about parenting or?
No. Okay. I just asked him. I said, I need a, we're going to adopt a baby and we need a reference.
Okay.
And he said, certainly, no problem, because he knew me,
So you go up to St. Mullen, you go up to the St. Joseph's baby home, and what happens?
With the letter and all that.
Yeah. And this is the first time they've met you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And we were shown into a room which, well, when you're looking back 53 or 54 years, it seemed to be full of babies.
Yeah.
And we were told, pick one. Now, whether they were boys or girls, I do not know. So I left it to my wife. I said, look, you go ahead, and we walk around. And just she selected a child, yeah. And that was it.
And did you... So how many babies were in this room?
Well, God, it seemed to be quite full. It was as Samullen as a large... was a large residence, private residence, way back in the day, apparently, with lots of land around it, you know. There seemed to be, it seemed to be full of babies. And okay. I often got the impression that if we had to say we'd take two, then none would be delighted.
And who did the choosing?
I let my wife choose the baby.
And did she ever say to you on what basis she chose the baby?
No.
How could you?
She just took a fancy to one little guy, and that was it. He's now a grandfather.
And what age is he now?
He'd be 54, I think. Well, he's a grandfather.
Well, that's young. And does he know? He knows the story, I presume.
Of course, because we actually, about 2 years ago, he was home in Ireland, and we were leaving his sister back to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way back from the airport, for some reason or other, I never know whether it was just fate, he said, I tell you what, instead of going the motorway, let's go the old road and see what it's like back home.
Yeah.
And we were coming, passing through Gormanstown, when there was a sign that said Stamullen. He said, hey, that brings back memories.
Yeah.
So he says, will we go up and have a look through it? Yeah, I said, sure, but say that home is closed down now. It was after the babies were left the home. It was used as a home for people with dementia.
Mm.
And then it eventually closed down too as well. It wasn't suitable for purpose, so they had to build new buildings beside it. So anyway, we found a home. I do remember there was a big driveway up to it. It was obviously locked up. And... That was it. We took some photographs of the place and back home then.
But when you were going and told when you arrived in Stamullen, as I say, just over 50 years ago, did were you brought into a room and interviewed?
No.
Okay.
Just as far as I know, well, they probably and answered a few questions. Well,
okay, but when they opened the letter, did they say, well, we're going to ring the priest just to be doubly sure this is the same priest?
Not that I recall, no.
So the first time they got the letters when you handed it to them?
Yes.
They read the letter and said, go ahead, go in and pick a baby.
He put it like that, yes.
And you said, you think if you said, can we have two, they would have said...
Well, I got that impression. Like, there seemed to be so many of them, but, you know, your memory can deceive you when you're looking back over the years, but there was certainly, it was a large room with... A lot of babies in it.
Okay. And did your son, who's still young, but you say he's also a grandfather, he's living in London, I think you said, did you?
Yes, that's right.
Runs. Has he found anything else about anything out about his birth mother?
Yeah, he's in the process at the moment, Joe.
Okay.
He has been given a few details. The only thing I will say to you over the phone is that he was told a bit of... information he has so far that he was left in Stamullen 3 days after he was born.
Yeah.
He knows the county he was born in at this stage and a few other things, but it's a slow process.
And did you adopt other children? I think you did.
Oh, yeah, we did. But 2 years after that, we decided to go again and got in contact with Stamullen. As far as I recall, we didn't have to bring a letter and was told to arrive to go to Stamullen on a certain such and such a date. Arrived up and the nun greeted us, and I knew there was something wrong.
Yeah.
And she said, "I'm sorry," she says, "the baby." Now this time we didn't get into a room to select.
Okay.
She said the baby that we had for you, they discovered this. There was a mental problem in the background, the family background. Now, she says, we can't say whether there's anything wrong with the child or not, but because we're not 100% sure, we just can't put this child up for adoption yet.
Mm.
But however, she says, we have another little fella here. He's 2 months old and he's only 8 pounds. And I said, she says, if you wish. I said, well, is he healthy? Yeah, she says, yeah, he's healthy. He's just small, like, you know.
Okay.
So I said, okay, we'll have that. That was it. It was all rather informal.
And obviously they were given the communication and contact you still have with your son, and as you say, his grandchildren. It worked out very well, but wasn't on the basis of interrogation for trying to find out whether you'd be a suitable parent or not. They were lucky that they got such good, such beautiful parents.
You know, it's I know that in later years when the babies became very scarce, that it wasn't as easy as we had it. You know, there was all sorts of interviews, okay. And you know, they were trying to match. If you, I know one a personal friend of mine. He adopted a child, and they were trying to match his, you know, the colour of his hair with the baby, and you know that they look alike. If you know,
crazy.
You understand what I'm trying to say.
Lunacy.
Yeah.
Okay, James. Good to meet him, Hogger. Kind regards, James McCourt, to you and your family.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Listening to survivors challenging aspects of the Mother and Baby Home Commission report, some of them in forensic detail about names and where there are names, which are very few, as in the case of Peggy McCarthy, and the description given to her by the commission is totally, well, you heard the upset by Tony Gearn of the description given to that woman. And I mentioned earlier that in Castle Pollard, one of the five people that gave evidence said that she learned that the adopted parents of her child in the States handed money over to the nuns at Castle Pollard and the payments continued for a number of years, quotes. And then the commission just put in a footnote. The witness did not provide any evidence to substantiate this claim. I don't know how you would. I made that point. Now, Michael Bourne, who's in Boston in the USA. Michael, good afternoon. Good morning to you.
Good morning from Boston. Yeah.
And you're saying you can provide evidence that you were sold.
A dollar amount shown, but it is in the letters that corresponded between my birth parents, my adopted parents, sorry.
And you were adopted.
And,
you were adopted from Chum.
Yes.
In 19.
No, I was actually born in Chum.
Born, okay.
And removed at 7 days old by my birth mother, and placed in St. Patrick's Temple Hill in Dublin.
Okay, and
where I remained for 4 years.
Okay, and what evidence have you got that money changed hands?
Correspondence between my mother, my adopted mother, and St. Patrick's Guild, Dublin, on their letterhead.
And you're saying it doesn't mention an amount, but it does mention money, but is it clear that money is for, well, how else would it be? But is it clear that money was for the fact that they adopted a baby? Because I'm going back to the commission report. And it says, 257 reference, many allegations have been made that large sums of money were given to institutions and agencies in Ireland that arranged foreign adoptions. Such allegations are impossible to prove and impossible to disprove.
I have a pile of these letters from St. Patrick's School, and I apologize, but I'm just sorting through them now to find
You keep sorting through them, and I know you're in Boston, so there's a time difference. And I'll read this out, then I'll call a break, and you can have the documentation. But the commission also says a number of witnesses to the commission spoke about donations they believe were sent by their adoptive parents following their adoption in the USA. Such donations, this is the commission, such donations were not illegal and could not be described as unethical unless the adoptive parents were trying to adopt another child. We'll be back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
We're talking to Michael Bourne because I mentioned earlier that the commission said no evidence in one case by one of the witnesses from Castle Pollard, one of the survivors. No evidence was given that money had changed hands for an American adoption. Well, Michael has contacted us, and I'm now looking at the two letters because Alison O'Reilly in yesterday's Daily Star, Alison has done great work going back years on this. She is has published those two letters. Have you got them in front of you now, Michael?
Unfortunately,
Okay, well, I read so much paperwork. Okay, well, I have it here. It says, we at Catholic Charities are very grateful for your generosity and thoughtfulness. It is only through the fees we receive from our adoptive couples that we are able to carry on our work here. Now, that's in one of your letters. And the other letter is from St. Patrick's Guild in Dublin. Which is not to be confused with the St. Patrick's Home in Dublin, which again is a bizarre communication because it says, please don't give details about this child. Refer to him as an unknown child. Just in case things do not work out, it would be better if Catholic Charities, when sending their report and recommendation, did not mention him at all. Just to do their report in the ordinary way without any reference to any specific child. This is also an account of the regulation of His Grace, our Archbishop John Charles McRae, that no specific child be promised to any couple unless they had been approved by him.
Mm-hmm.
Be sure.
I have a letter to that effect.
Yeah. Okay, and have you ever managed to track your birth mother, or do you wish to, Michael?
I have. Okay. I found her passed away in Philadelphia. She passed in 2001.
Okay.
Found her in an unmarked grave.
Oh, God.
I bought her a headstone since.
But where was she from originally, Michael, do you know?
Yes, Charlestown, Mayo.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And she ended she ended up in the USA, and you ended up in the USA.
Yes, obviously I was adopted here, but I don't know her story. No one knows it.
Okay.
And I, probably like a lot of mothers, she left in shame,
yeah.
You know, from everything that transpired with her, you know.
Yeah, shame, love and shame.
But, and she must have gone through a lot. She was given a pain medicine while that's in tomb that gave me a birth defect. Thalidomide. You know, let me just talk about those experimental drugs that they gave us as well. I went through six operations when I came to Boston to correct my legs. Still not right.
Okay. And do you know how this was caused, Michael?
The drug? Thalidomide.
You believe it was the drug? Has that been proved?
I don't. I bet somebody has those records.
I know that. I'm just trying to work out the dates. But because we know, again, this is another kettle of worms, and that is that vaccination trials were carried out on, I don't think Tuam was included, on a number of mother and baby homes by GlaxoSmithKline, with the aid and abettance of a number of medics, but without the permission, obviously, of the children, but without the permission of the children or guardians or relatives of those children. It's shocking. And they were trials carried out on children without their knowledge or indeed permission. Completely unethical. Michael Bourne, Michael in Boston in the United States. Thanks indeed, and it's a good morning to Michael because he's in the USA.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Joe at RT.ie. Margaret, good afternoon. You took care of sick babies, as you say, in the mother and baby homes. How did that come about, Margaret?
No, I didn't. I didn't take care of the baby's home. I was nursing in Surrey Orchard during infectious diseases training in 1967 to 69.
Okay.
And we went over to the Navan Road, St. Patrick's, in the ambulance, the nurses at that time, to pick up the babies, to bring them back to Cherry Orchard with gastroenteritis, mostly, you know. So we nursed them then in Cherry Orchard. And I just wanted to ring up to say that those ladies who rang up and said that the babies were in bad condition when they came to us, a lot of them were. they would have had gastroenteritis and they would have very, very sore bottoms.
Oh,
and we had a wonderful sister on the ward, Ward 11, where a lot of the babies were. She was just wonderful. My memories of it is, you know, the 2-bar and the 1-bar electric fires that we had years ago?
Yeah.
She would have 2 and 3 of those in the room with them all connected to one another, and the baby on its mouth and nose in the room with the baby's bottom up, because the actual baby's bottom would be bleeding. From so that's my memories of it. And then we had to feed these babies. We couldn't take them up and let them sit on our lap as it would normally be. We had to feed them at an angle. So they, so that is so true. The babies were very ill when they came into us.
My God. And what age were you, Margaret, when you were...
I was 16 and a half. I went to do my my infectious diseases training, which was a cert at that time, for 2 years. And I spent the 2 years in Cherry Orchard, got my cert, stayed on for 6 months before I went on to James's to do my general training. And then went back to Cherry Orchard for 8 months, stat nurse, in 1972, before I went to do my midwifery. And so I have vivid memories of all of that.
And Margaret, do you, insofar as you can, how many times would you have had to go from Cherry Orchard, which was a fever hospital, wasn't it? That's what we were.
Yes, infectious diseases.
We live beside it,
yes.
But how many times would you have gone across to the Navan Road to bring children in the ambulance?
Numerous. It's so vivid, loads of times, because not alone did we go over to the Navan Road to collect the babies, when we took them to Cherry Orchard and we treated them, they had to have 3 negative reports before we could take them back. So we also brought them back to the Navan Road in the ambulance, you know. And my memories of it is going into, we were told when we would go to pick up these babies that we didn't look left or right. We just went up to the nursery, picked up the baby. And my vivid memories is girls on the steps of the stairs. You know, there was maybe 10 steps and a platform and 10 more steps. And the girls were there with little scrubbing brushes, scrubbing between the iron steps. You know, maybe 4 or 5, maybe 6 of them. But so many times I was there. And then, you see, we went to Temple Hill, where the babies were over there for adoption, and we brought the children from there in with gastroenteritis, with, you know, into the Cherry Orchard.
And gastroenteritis, it's not talked about much. It's an awful illness,
isn't it? It's an awful, yes. Well, if it's not treated quickly, and they can get sick very quickly. And, you see, the babies would be so ill when they would come into us. Normally, you would put up an intravenous infusion into their arms, but they would be so sick, it would have collapsed, so we would have to go through their ankle, you know, the veins in their ankle. Mm. And then we put a little plaster of Paris around their ankle, little strips of plaster of Paris to keep it in position, because the babies would wriggle.
Good move,
so,
of course,
you know, and then you would have to, it was, yes, I have such memories.
Oh, God. And I was reading in the report, I think it was last night, about when there was an outbreak, and there was lots of outbreaks of gastroenteritis in the Regina Celi Hospital. And it's highly infectious, isn't it? It travels
very infectious,
easily
very
among
infectious
babies. But the symptoms of the poor babies, what they went through was just in terms of diarrhea and coughing and the distress was just horrific, horrific.
Yes.
Well, Margaret, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
And
all the nurses and that. I know it's still operating as a hospital and a medical facility, but that's Margaret talking about the condition of the babies in the mother and baby homes. Margaret, thank you so much. And,
Joe, thank you.
God bless you. Bye-bye. Back tomorrow, 1:45. Lisa Marie, Berry produced, and Ray Darcy's next.